everyone, and welcome to Odd Trilogies with Logan and Andy. I'm Logan Sowash.
And I'm Andy Carr.
And on Odd Trilogies, we take a trio of films, whether tied by cast and crew, thematic elements, numerical order, etc., and we discuss the good, the bad, and the weird surrounding each one of those entries. And today, it's good to be back. It's been a little bit of time in between our last... We both had to look at each other and be like, was Chris Pratt the last trilogy we did? And it was. And
yeah, it's been a while since we've been in the trilogy game. It's been even longer since we did kind of just our traditional setup of just you and me.
Yeah.
Because the last time was with our special friend and Lego Lord, Austin Webster.
Yeah, the local master builder himself, yeah. Austin Webster, who, as of this recording, even though we always record live, but he just did a guest spot on our website for Kinds of Kindness.
Yeah. Because, pumped out a little review for us, which was awfully kind of him.
It was, one of the kinds of kindness he got.
One of the kinds of kindness is movie reviews.
It is movie reviews. It is also when we both said, yeah, one of us should do Kinds of Kindness. And you said, yeah, I'll do it. And then we both leave the theater and look at each other
like,
and go,
what? And then you pointed at me and said, good luck.
Yeah. Which, to be fair, I think after a day or two, I now could probably do a review of it.
Yeah.
But immediately after,
Saturday, the day after we saw it, I sat down to write. And I got two paragraphs that I was really happy with. But then I was like, I don't know what the fuck else I'm going to write. And then and then Austin kind of seemingly half jokingly said he'd write it, and I took him up on that.
Yeah. And it's a great article. Yeah. I mean, I'm glad he did that. We're excited to have more guest writers in the future if they are interested.
Sure. I would always rather somebody passionate about the movie in question, whether they love it or hate it, passionate about it, write about it, than me put out a, you know, a 2.5 or a 3, and I'm like, I don't even know what I'm saying at this point. So, yeah, thank you, Austin, for that.
Yes, absolutely. But today on Odd Trilogies, it is not going to be about Yorgos Lanthimos. It is not even going to be Kevin Costner yet, which will be our next episode after
this.
Spoilers for all those who were waiting to see what the next one was going to be after this. No, today we are going to talk about a sampler trilogy about an actor and a director that personally I really enjoy and really excited to see where they go in their career, in their collaboration kind of relationship as time goes on. And in honor of their latest release, which is The Bike Riders, we've decided to talk about the collaboration relationship between Mike Nichols and Michael Shannon as a lead actor in his films.
Jeff Nichols.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for
letting me. Jeff Nichols and Jeff Shannon.
Yes, Jeff Shiggles, which I need to also address because apparently there's been enough time in between the Chris Pratt episode and now. For some reason in my brain, I thought Mike Nichols was Jeff Nichols' son. Mike Nichols is the prolific director behind The Graduate, as well as many others in his career. He has decades of films under his filmography that, like, The Graduate is, like, the easiest one to go to, but there is, pick a genre, pick a decade, you'll probably find something from him. I swear to God, years ago, I thought I saw an article, not just out of the whim, saying that they were related in some way, shape, or form. I took that as fact. It was not at all fact.
Yeah, I think I thought for a while that Jeff Nichols was Mike Nichols' son.
Yeah. Which at the same time, and you can even see when I did it right now, because when someone asked what is the most iconic Nichols filmmaker, my brain automatically went Mike.
Right.
Which is not the case here, because it actually is Jeff Nichols, who is a director honest to God, I love the fact that he's not Mike Nichols' son, because in a sense, Jeff Nichols... He's no Goro Miyazaki in this. In fact, Jeff Nichols is... straight up from his first film all the way up to The Bike Riders, kind of just homegrown, has built his career over some very fascinating films.
Yeah.
From the first film, which we will talk about today, all the way up to his most recent film, which we actually talked about in a quickie a few weeks ago when The Bike Riders came out. And the films we actually are talking about today through Jeff Nichols' career and with Shannon are 2007's Shotgun Stories, Nichols' directorial debut, 2011's Take Shelter, which may or may not be his most critically acclaimed film, and 2016's Midnight Special, which is a bit of a sleeper that I think came out at a weird time for him, especially critically, because at the same time, another one of his films came out probably a few months in the kind of span.
With the Joel Edgerton movie, Edgerton's Loving.
Yes, Loving.
Yeah. The only one of these that I actually remember like releasing was Midnight Special.
Yeah.
But that's probably just because, you know, he had developed more of a name for himself at that point. He'd already done Mud, the
yes.
Matthew McConaughey movie.
That's probably
and
his
I was
most
also
popular film.
Older and was more
wiser,
you know, yeah, exposed to just movie news and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But Shotgun Stories is kind of the indie one of these three. It's a pretty, at least seems to be a fairly obscure movie to
yeah.
most people's perception.
Oh, it's again,
so I'm glad we're digging into
it. I think with we'll get to Midnight Special, but Midnight Special's cast, especially at the time, is wild even now.
Yeah.
So it'll be fun to really talk more about that. But yeah, today we are discussing, even though Michael Shannon has been in all of Nichols's films as of right now, Shannon really has only been a lead in three of them.
Yeah.
In the rest of them, he is a supporting character. And again, that doesn't make him any less performance-wise in terms of the amount of commitment he puts into those films.
Yeah.
Like, we even, with the Bike Riders, even with that, like, Shannon is, like, a small part in that film, but every time he shows up, it's just a delight to see Shannon just
yeah.
be one of the boys
well,
in,
and
a,
his,
in a motorcycle film.
Yeah, his frequency being in Nichols films, clearly there is this relationship there, and the fact that he's led three of them is, like, you know, natural angle to pursue.
Yeah, and just a little bit of background for both Jeff Nichols and Michael Shannon. Jeff Nichols was born in 1978 in Little Rock, Arkansas. Michael Shannon was born in 1974. Shannon's first film is Groundhog's Day. He basically yeah. plays the groom in A Married Couple. It's the one that yells WrestleMania at the very end
yeah.
of the film. They're in, I think, one or two other scenes before that, but he, I think at that point, he's like 20, 21
mm-hmm.
when that film comes out. And post that film, I think Shannon is in a decent amount of stuff in the 90s, going into the early to mid-2000s as well, but a lot of that is antagonistic roles or supporting character roles, or sometimes he is never the marquee name
yeah.
on a poster.
Kind of a character actor.
Yeah, you know, Shannon absolutely is the best way to describe
yeah.
him with that. And, I mean, to start off talking about Shannon, I think the best way to, you know, break open the conversation in terms of his performances, I have to ask you, Andy, what was your first Michael Shannon film?
I mean, the first movie I watched and like took note of the fact that that's Michael Shannon was probably Man of Steel. Like probably
okay.
my normie.
That's fair.
But I mean, I had already seen by that point, just looking at his filmography, I'd already seen several of his movies just without
yeah.
recognizing him. I mean, apparently he's in Pearl Harbor.
That doesn't surprise me.
And I don't remember him in Pearl Harbor, but I also watched that movie when I was really young and didn't
yeah,
know who
yeah,
he
yeah.
was. But yeah, he was also in Kangaroo Jack.
That is my first Michael
yeah.
Shannon film.
Yeah.
He plays Jerry O'Connell's mafia stepbrother, I believe. Oh, is the,
okay.
Because I think yeah. the whole... Because again, I got to remember with Kangaroo Jack, because Kangaroo Jack is a film that exists that came out of the early 2000s.
Mm,
but
truly.
I believe in that film, it's like Jerry O'Connell's mom marries a mafia boss.
Okay.
That mafia boss, I think, passes away or like is not doing so hot. And so like his son steps up and that's Michael Shannon. Because the whole premise, do you even know what the premise of Kangaroo Jack is?
I have seen Kangaroo Jack. It's
okay.
been almost
yeah.
2 decades probably.
It's basically Jerry O'Connell and Anthony Anderson are pulled into like I think a drug or like a weapons
yeah,
deal.
Yeah.
And they put money in a jacket
right.
or in a hoodie.
Right.
They put the hoodie
on
the kangaroo because it'd be funny.
Yeah.
And that's the actual plot of a film you think
yeah.
would be more about a talking kangaroo, which it wasn't. But that's the kind of where Shannon's career is in the early 2000s because
yeah.
like now when you talk about Michael Shannon, I think he's gotten so much more love from many other directors. He's worked with Sam Mendes. He's worked
mm-hmm.
with Ryan Johnson. He's worked with, like Andy said, with Snyder as Zod
yeah.
on Man of Steel, as well as most recently with Andy Muschietti in The Flash.
Oh, yes.
Which,
course.
If you have not seen Michael Shannon talk about The Flash, do yourself a favor and do, because it's just someone being so... so just transparent about their feelings about how a cinematic universe works. Yeah. He's also worked with Del Toro in The Shape of Water, another phenomenal performance for him.
He played Elvis in that Elvis and Nixon movie.
Yeah, I don't know who played Nixon in that film. It's a little fuzzy there.
Yeah.
But, ultimately with Michael Shannon, especially in his early career.
Kevin Spacey.
I knew who it was. That was the joke.
Oh, okay.
The joke was I knew and I was pretending I didn't.
I didn't remember.
Oh, that's funny. But, Shannon in his early years is an actor who, when he pops up, 9 times out of 10, you probably saw him, recognized him, but didn't fully know it was,
Michael Shannon. He's one of those guys. He's one of those guy actors.
Yes.
At least was for a long time.
An easy way to describe as a character actor.
Yeah.
And what starts the relationship between Michael Shannon and Jeff Nichols is very fascinating because in the early to mid-2000s, Jeff Nichols was in film school in North Carolina. And while he was in film school, he wrote his directorial debut script, Shotgun Stories, the first film in our trilogy, and always had the lead, Son Hayes, in mind for Michael Shannon. Here's the thing. He is a film school graduate, which means he has no money, understandably so. Any college graduate usually is the no money category 9 times out of 10. And so when he gets out and he's trying to contact Shannon because he thinks he could, you know, it's a long shot until he realizes his former teacher, I believe, is going to a film convention or he's doing something where Michael Shannon is actually going to be working with his former teacher.
Yeah.
He's able to give the script to his former teacher. He's like, can you please ask Michael Shannon if he'll do this movie? The teacher gets to run into Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon, I believe the way he tells the story, he gives him like one of those stares that you can just see in your brain, a Michael Shannon, like, are you fucking kidding me stare? And he tells the former teacher, all right, just send the script like in the mail, send it to my house, I'll read it later. Shannon reads the script to Shotgun Stories and has said still to this day it's one of the best scripts he's ever read. And goes, fuck it, I need to meet this kid. So he meets with Jeff Nichols. And Jeff outright, this is again, this is all from Michael Shannon on his kind of like years in review talking about his career.
Like career
I think for Vanity Fair. But he basically said, like, Jeff Nichols went, listen, I don't have a big budget, and any money that I could scrounge up for said budget is going to go for the film for the camera. So I don't know if I'm not going to be able to pay you with much, but my mom makes delicious food, and she will make you dinner if you're okay with it. And Shannon was basically like, fuck it, I'm in. And that's what we have, Shotgun Stories, a film that I genuinely believe is, like, just, if you're looking for, like, what you want in your directorial debut to, like, just be, like, quality-wise, I feel like this is just a very obtainable kind of space. Because Shotgun Stories is not Jeff Nichols' best film, but my God, does it give you an idea of how Jeff Nichols sees, like, how he writes, how he sees through a camera, how he directs his actors.
It's like, remarkably self-assured.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not, you know, it's not doing anything horribly ambitious from like a technical perspective or anything, but it is like, it looks pretty great for its shoestring budget. And there's a lot of, the thing I remember most about this movie is the like the editing, like really sharp, intentional, you know, character driven editing that I think is really cool. And yeah, like you said, kind of shows the foundation of who he is as a filmmaker and all of his other stuff. It's a really pretty impressive kind of like workmanlike film, and like you said, it's attainable, like which sounds like a backhanded compliment. But it's really like, this feels like if you're, I mean, I think all like first time filmmakers probably experience the thing of like, here's what I want to make, and then you go and make it and it's nothing like you wanted to make it. And this feels almost like a dream, where it feels like, surely this is exactly how it was set out to be made, because it just seems so right.
It seems like a lot of the conversations when directors or actors talk about their favorite experiences on films, it is like, you know, the obtainable kind of goal is they try to have almost a summer camp quality to the energy on set versus still a professionalism to like be like, we are working on a piece of work that is, you know, we're going to be seen by, you know, hopefully hundreds, thousands of people, maybe millions if we're lucky. So, like, let's put our hearts and soul into it and have a confidence that I think, you know, when you think of directorial debuts, confidence can be a difficult thing to do because, again, like Andy said, it's like you're going in, it's your first film. Not everything's going to go the way that it's planned.
Yeah, yeah.
And lo and behold, with Nichols, even going into this film, having already seen that his career goes into a place where it's like, yeah, he knows exactly what he's doing. He's a talented auteur. It is still just fascinating to watch Shotgun Stories being like, this guy is just, when this film comes out, it's probably like they shot it when like Jeff Nichols is like 28, 29. And there's a confidence in the writing. There's a confidence in the direction. There's a confidence, like you said, in the editing. Like, there's just, it's one of those films where it's like, this is like a 7 out of 10 to me.
Yeah.
But it's a 7 out of 10 that I can't wait to, like, watch again. Like, in the future, I'll definitely watch it again. And I think there's highlights in the acting, like, iconically when it comes to Michael Shannon. Michael Shannon, when he talks about this film, the one scene he brings up a lot, which I think is, like, the best moment with Shannon as an actor in this movie, is the hospital scene.
Oh,
there's a there's a specific hospital scene where Shannon's character, Son Hayes, who is the, basically the story is almost like it's a Steinbeck-esque family feud between two families that have the same father, but Michael Shannon's family basically had the father when he was a drunk, and he was abusive,
yeah,
and then the other family that's feuding with him basically had him when he was like a reformed
Christian.
Got
his shit together, and, yeah.
And so, like, one side of the family sees their father as a good man, while the other side sees him as a giant piece of shit.
Well, and right at the start of the movie, the father
passes
dies.
Away. Yes.
So there's this, like, tension.
Yeah, the inciting incident ends up being a funeral monologue that probably shouldn't have ended the way that it should have.
Yeah.
And Michael Shannon's character even admits, yeah, I probably shouldn't have done that, but when else? When are we ever going to say that again? And leads to just a very, you know, just kind of an old school, like, kind of drama vibe that feels perfect, especially for the podunk kind of southern town energy that it's going for.
Yeah.
And in the film, like, for the majority of it, Michael Shannon as an actor is very much, you're seeing him, and it's like he is holding down the fort in terms of acting. This man, Shannon, has always been good at eyebrow, eye, stoic acting. He is always good with just acting with very little
understated
mannerisms.
Not and a ton of expression.
So when we get to a scene in Shotgun Stories where it's in a hospital and he breaks down, it is very clearly like, this, no wonder this is the scene that Shannon has stuck to nearly two decades later, because it's like, that's the scene where, after, you know, this is a 90 minute film. And ultimately, like, we're like an hour or so in when this scene happens, and arguably when this scene happens, it's probably the big emotional moment in this film, is like having the, you know, the head of this side of the Hayes family just breaking down because of, you know, the consequences of this feud.
Yeah.
And the rest of the cast is also really good. The rest of the cast is mainly first timers, or at least, you know, maybe probably locals that we're shooting and do a really good job. One of the guys is one of the no-name actors plays a character named Shampoo Douglas, which is by far one of the best character side names I've ever heard, and it has stuck with me since I saw the film. And I remember when he said it again, I think I rewound it so I could hear it. Be like, did he just fucking call himself Shampoo Douglas? Phenomenal name. But this is a film where it's like, you would think, you know, in terms of just how much Shannon is working on, if it wasn't for the fact that you can tell that this is a low-budget film using every cent to basically convey the, you know, the tenacity, the emotions, the, you know, the intensity that comes from a story like like a feud like this, you would almost think in another world it's a vanity project, because it's like Shannon's holding it down. It really is like everyone else is doing a really good to great job, but then Shannon shows up and it's like, ah, fuck.
Yeah.
This man deserves more leading roles. And
yeah,
I mean, with Shotgun Stories, I feel like that's kind of a good template for how, you know, Shannon and Nichols will keep improving their career as it goes on, relationship-wise.
Yeah, and I think it also kind of sets up sort of the aesthetic foundation of, like, Jeff Nichols as a filmmaker.
Yes.
He's very interested in the kind of not entirely rural America, but sort of that sort of lower class South kind of social class and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Very Mark Twain-y. Like, I think the John Steinbeck, Mark Twain kind of, like, influences can be kind of felt.
Yeah.
And honestly, as somebody who has loved everything he's read of Twain, like, I get it. Yeah. And I think, like, with Nichols, you can definitely tell that, like, the man likes playing in the dirt, especially with his films. And
yeah, there's a gritty, literal grittiness to them. And yeah, this is just such a, like you said, it's not an amazing movie. I agree. It's like a 7 out of 10.
Yeah.
But it's an incredibly admirable 7 out of 10.
Yeah,
and it's kind of like a workhorse of a film. It feels it was very low budget, very economically produced. I mean, they shot the thing in 21 days.
21 days. And I think what Nichols has said is they scrounged up close to $250,000.
Yeah, yeah.
So, again, that's more than you would expect from seeing the film, but at the same time, considering how probably difficult it was in a lot of ways.
Well, and they were extremely, like, limited on crew too, so it's like, when you don't have the manpower, you have to really shoot around, like, I mean, the whole movie is basically set outdoors during daylight, so it's like, okay, good, we don't have to light anything.
and it's just like,
so it's just a really it's an impressively kind of humble film,
very naturalistic cinematography, lighting wise, and just kind of like, you know, design wise, because it has to be and it works in its favor,
and that I think ends up, even though Nichols goes on to make much bigger productions, like, that really, that visual style and tone really carries over into his other work.
It's hard not to, like, go into this, because I think out of all of these three films, I hadn't seen either Take Shelter or Shotgun Stories when we decided to do this, but, like, Shotgun Stories was the one I was the most curious about, because, like, one, when we started talking about doing this trilogy, Shotgun Stories was nowhere legally. Which it is now, thankfully. I think lo and behold, our original release date for this was just 2 days before it was going to get re-released on, like, DVD and Blu-ray.
Yeah.
But now you can watch it. I think you can watch it streaming now as well. And we would both recommend it. Again, it's a 7 out of 10, but it's a 7 out of 10 I would highly recommend, especially if you have seen other Jeff Nichols films and you're curious as to where he started, because you can watch this and be like, well, shit, this is one hell of a film to start off your career with.
Yeah.
And going off from that, I mean, from 2007 to 2011, I believe we're still in the point of Nichols's career where we don't get to his most popular film, which is Mud, which I believe
Mud is
after
2012.
That's a year after our next film. But this film, I think, is the one that, honestly, even though I didn't see a Jeff Nichols film until Midnight Special, this is probably the first film I had heard about Jeff Nichols and was like, this is somebody I should probably start watching. And that's our second film in our trilogy, 2011's Take Shelter. I mean this in the best way possible, because I want everyone to know that what we're about to talk about is probably my favorite film of the three. I initially gave this film an 8.5 out of 10, and now in between when I saw this and now recording, I've now bumped it to a 9 because it hasn't left my mind since I saw it. It is the film that, like, you know, now looking back, this is kind of the film where I wish Shannon got more love for this performance, which we will talk about more about. But I will say,
you could easily see this being like a watershed moment in his career.
But I will say, with all that said, with how much I love this film, Take Shelter is a very, very uncomfortable film. It is a film that is dealing with, you would think, supernatural, maybe sci-fi-ish elements, but ultimately it is a backdrop for a story about a man dealing with the possibility that he has a mental illness. And that alone is, you think, oh, I can see that being enough for a story. And it would be if it wasn't for the fact that Jeff Nichols goes hard in terms of discussing, not only is this man dealing with trying to figure out if this mental illness, if he has a mental illness very similar in his family history, because the story is basically a working class man starts having visions of a
apocalyptic storm
coming through. And initially you think the film is going to be about him making a shelter and people thinking he's crazy, but he knows 100% in his mind that he is right. That is not the case. What is really the case about the film is that for the film, the majority about it is him questioning if these hallucinations are real or not, because in his family history, this coincides with a type of schizophrenia that his mother had.
Yeah.
And so, I think it's paranoid schizophrenia.
I think it is. Yeah.
And so, we are watching a man who is the, you know, breadwinner in the family. He is making the money that is basically, you know, funding the house, basically helping with his daughter's disability because she is deaf.
Yeah.
She's like 4 or 5 years old, I think. And so this is a man who is like, you know, is basically told out loud by his best friend in this film, played by Shea Whigham, is that like, you have like the perfect life.
Yeah.
Basically, you have like the life that anyone would ask for. Basically being told your life is perfect, mm-hmm. having one of the biggest bombs dropped on you, and watching this man try to figure out how to even comprehend that aspect while also dealing with hallucinations that he deals with almost on a nightly basis.
Yeah, it becomes kind of this cycle of like, during the day I'm gonna hide my research of this from my wife, mm-hmm. and then at night I get haunted by visions, and so I go out and try and mess with this storm shelter I'm making.
This is a film where I could genuinely see, yeah, not only does it make people uncomfortable, it could also horrify you a little bit, just in fact of like watching him be a bit of a hypochondriac about, you know, going super deep into what he thinks his disease is and trying to figure out what this is. Also, just like, if you don't like the look of like a hospital or like a government kind of like white wall, white ceiling kind of setting, this definitely has a lot of those scenes that made me uncomfortable. Just very a sterile environment, which is like, you know, in most situations when it comes to a hospital, like again, in Shotgun Stories, the hospitals aren't, they even have, when I think of the Shotgun Stories, kind of like hospital scenes, it's like a tinge of yellow.
Mm.
Almost adds to the kind of like small town, kind of small hospital vibe, but it's like, it's a good place. It's supposed to be a place where, you know, of course you get to get fixed and you get to get healed and whatnot. While in Take Shelter, there is a sterile uncomfortability, like lack of humanity in the design of those scenes where it's like, you're trying to get help, but at the same time, it feels like you're wasting. It's so fascinating how this film really is. Like in the first 30 minutes, you're like, okay, I could probably see where the film is going. I'm very curious how it continues doing this for 90 minutes. And then an hour hits. And then 90 minutes hit. And then it gets towards the end of the 2-hour runtime, and I'm like, Jesus, this film just keeps going deeper and deeper into this hole to a point where it's like genuinely uncomfortable for a good reason. It is trying to bring light the idea of like the difficulties of not only dealing with either having a mental illness or trying to discover, you know, health problems in general, but also, you know, your loved ones discussing
the family relationships involved when you have
again, another aspect of this, because unlike Shotgun Stories, where I think like, you know, with Shotgun Stories, there's an ensemble there that is like really, really good and definitely lifts up Shannon in a way that is like, they're all really good, but Shannon is key to the story. Shannon is key to Take Shelter, but I really think what accents him even just as well is how fucking good Jessica Chastain is as his wife. Great. Like, the fact that she got nominated for an Oscar the year this would have gotten nominated, but instead got nominated for The Help.
Oh, yeah.
Which she's good in. I think she's good in that. But compared to Take Shelter, it is kind of like, it's probably one of my favorite Chastain performances.
She is
terrified for most of the film, because it's like, if her husband is keeping things from her that she is realizing, like, you're clearly keeping something from me and you're not telling me. And then coming home to find, like, a hole in her backyard. Their family dog, who's an inside dog, being forced to live outside because he had a visceral hallucination. Like, it's...
Yeah.
There's just so much to it.
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely terrified the whole film. She's also, like, even in the scenes where she's most scared, it like really struck me how like, I guess how strong she was.
Yes.
In the film, because she's very. Shannon's character is somebody who does not really talk about himself.
No.
He's, you know, he's a working man. He's a blue collar worker. I think he does, is it core drilling or something like
that?
Yeah,
he's part of a core drill. I think core drilling.
And yeah, he just goes, works long days, comes home, works on a home improvement project, and goes to bed. And he kind of dismisses any other concerns other than like, is his family okay? And so when you know, he starts to get kind of panicked and paranoid and going into these little little research projects on his own and not telling his wife, and she starts finding out about it, the way that she faces him is really cool and, like, forces him to express things. And obviously part of that's the script, but Chastain just really, really nails that element of, like, I am scared. And because of that, I'm going to face you and do something about it.
Yeah.
And force you to help me make this better.
Yeah. It's like, I'm not only, it's also like on top of that to, you know, add on, and it's just, not only am I scared, I'm also mad at
you
because you are hiding.
You being selfish. Yeah.
Yeah. Because again, it's like, it's one of those films too, where it's like, Shannon is ashamed of the possibility that he could have a mental illness. As if he can control that.
Right.
And so for a good chunk of the film, at least for the first half or so, he tries to hide it.
Yeah.
And then when it becomes more apparent that there's more going on than just, you know, like, maybe little things here and there or stress that Chastain maybe thinks is from work, once she realizes that there's more to it, she genuinely, and I think in a good way, gets mad because it's like, again, we're married together, like,
right,
until
you
death
think
do us
I'm not
part.
A part of this deal, like,
yeah, yeah, you think I don't want to help?
Yeah.
And it is just fascinating. Again, there are inklings in Shotgun Stories where it's no surprise that he ends up making something like Take Shelter, but I didn't expect to go into Take Shelter and be like, oh, this movie is like, if you take the hospital scene from Shotgun Stories, which is Shannon's best moment performance-wise in that film, and you just sprinkle it all through the entire two-hour performance where it's just Shannon doing the best he can, doing his best internalized, you know, just like micro, you know, mannerisms on his face, just like slowly losing his mind without saying a single word to anybody.
Yeah.
This is probably my favorite Shannon performance.
I think so too.
Where I'm at.
Because he still has a lot of that from Shotgun Stories, that stoicism, that kind of rugged, understated micro expression stuff. But then, of course, you know, he's discovering he might have a mental illness, and he's having hallucinations and nightmares. And in those moments, he becomes, you know, this incredibly expressive, scared, you know, frightened little person. And so you kind of get to see all of it from him and kind of, I love the moments where he's kind of, he has those experiences and he's terrified as anybody would be. And then he kind of like puts the facade back on. It's like, all right, time to go back to work, get this taken care of, and pretend nothing happened.
Yeah. And I think, again, another aspect to it as well, that like, I just was so shocked that the film even talks about it, but it makes a lot of sense, is the fact that this is a film. There's one line in the film where at that point it's already been pretty apparent, this kind of aspect of the film, but there's a moment where Curtis's older brother, the actor escapes me, but he's been like Ford v Ferrari. I think he might've been in another Jeff Nichols film since this, but basically this actor like looks at his younger brother, Michael Shannon, and goes, really? You're going to build this shelter in this economy.
Right.
Which is a joke that has been, it's not, it's like,
it's a meme now.
It's a meme now, but to think that like, yeah, this is like barely a year or two after the housing bubble is probably when they shot this.
Right.
So to think that not only is this man worried about how is he going to provide for his family, how is he even going to try to provide for himself when he has no time in a normal schedule, but also, how the hell is he going to justify building a shelter due to hallucinations after the fucking housing crisis, probably in universe hurt a lot of the people that he knew and a lot of the communities that he's aware of. And, like, it just adds another element of, like, commentary to it where it's just, like, not only is it already difficult to get people, you know, the working class to, you know, feel like taking care of themselves is not a burden, especially also how the hospitals are not inherently scary, but they can be for some people.
Yeah.
You get the financial aspect and the most relevant financial aspect of that on top of that, where it's like, holy shit.
Yeah.
This movie doesn't have to discuss that at all.
Yeah.
Like, again, it's if it was just a Noah-esque story and it was that, like, straightforward, you could still probably get a good movie out of it by itself. But the fact that Nichols just keeps digging and digging with his characters and the narrative and the thematic elements, and also with the hallucinations, because the hallucinations are, you know, has they have CGI in them at times, and this still is a pretty low budget film at the moment. But in those dream sequences are visceral enough that it's hard not to be like, I get why this man is not okay with this or that. And or it's like having, it's like Jeff Nichols being like, hey, have you ever had a dream that has just felt so real that when you woke up, you just couldn't shake it off? What if you had a lead that just had that every night?
Right, right.
And it's like, that is horrifying. I would never want to be this man. And that's just, again, one aspect of this movie where it's like, you know, you add the other aspects of the fact that, like, they have friends, they have extended family who are just seen from the outside, like, he is just becoming more distant and cold and is being mean to his family without understanding that, like, they are going through so much internally that, like, it's really hard to discuss in a conversation because it's also constantly changing. And so it leads to just some phenomenal moments where it's like, there are moments in this film where my heart sinks and there's really nothing happening, like, big bombastic wise. There is a big bombastic scene in this movie.
Yeah.
Emotionally, which I would argue is probably, if I don't know if Shannon got even nominated for the Oscars for this.
I don't think so.
But if he did, that scene would probably be used
on the reel.
Yeah. And my God, it is just a film that arguably there's one honestly, in my head, there's one aspect of the film that I can understand if people do not like it. And I was actually curious to hear your thoughts on it because I don't even think I know. It's the ending.
Yeah, the ending really seems to divide people.
Yes.
I'll just say, you know, so there's no tension in the room. I really enjoyed the ending.
I did too.
I really enjoyed the film overall.
Oh, there would have been no tension if you not liked it. Honest to God, I would have been just, like, all right, let's talk about this.
Not trying to sound like I'm walking on eggshells or anything.
No, yeah.
But I will say, when I watched this movie, credits rolled, or the, you know, final scene happens, credits rolled, I sat there on the couch for 15 minutes just thinking, like, is that a good ending? Like,
I went back and forth
on, like, did I hate that? Was that stupid? Was that actually kind of awesome?
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's one of those endings that really makes you go back over the rest of the movie and think, what is my read on this? Like, what do I take away from it?
And
you know, the my favorite read of the movie meant a really great read of the ending. And so I'm really happy that it ended that way. And I also understand why people don't like it, because I think it really depends on your interpretation of what's happening throughout the movie.
Yes. Yeah,
how
yeah.
you receive the ending, because like, my knee jerk to the ending was like, oh, you just cheapened everything.
Yes. It's like the main argument for that ending, or against that ending, which makes sense, is the fact that, like, the film itself is clearly symbolic and is discussing the idea of the importance of mental illness, discussing it with the people that you love, being, you know, kind
trusting
to yourself,
the people you love,
trusting
to
them,
support you, and,
being kind to yourself, and arguably just realizing that just because you have this illness, that doesn't make you broken to the point where you can't be fixed or that you can't go on with your life.
Yeah.
And in my head, yes, I could understand, you know, devil's advocate wise, I could understand why people don't like the ending, because you would think, it almost implies that this whole journey was for nothing. And in my mind,
well, and
I disagree
also
with that.
It suggests, at least on a cursory read, it suggests that maybe all of the mental illness angle of this movie is kind of irrelevant.
It could. It could see that.
Depending on how you interpret the ending.
Yeah. But in my head, I think what I loved about the ending the most is that the ending, in my mind, is not the emotional climax.
Yeah, sure.
The emotional climax, and I think which really makes the film by itself just a satisfying experience, is, of course, convincing Curtis to leave the bunker.
Yes.
At the very end.
Yeah.
Because in my head,
three of them in the bunker.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
Because in my head, it doesn't matter if the last 5 or 6 minutes is actually proving him right on the hallucinations or if it's something else completely differently.
Yeah.
It's the fact that he is able to take this olive branch from his wife and his daughter who love him to admit that there might be something wrong with him and that's okay because it's not the end of the world.
Yeah. And, and
that's enough for me.
And the ending, to me, is basically just a button on it. It's a statement on where this family is now.
Yes.
And what they've been through together, and now they're ready to face
and I would even,
anything.
Yeah, and I would even argue, just to even accent more, and like, you know, accentuate more just how fucking good Shannon is in this film, is that in that scene, in the bunker, is like the most, like, genuinely the most vulnerable he has ever gotten in the movie.
Yeah, he's almost childlike.
Yes.
In the bunker scene.
And to go from that to the final scene where the last line he has to his wife is like, it's going to be okay, kind of like that. Just how calm, how collected, and seemingly how almost determined he is when he says that, where he sees that storm and he feels like he can still take on that storm, I think implies that the development that he's had as a character, even though the storm is real, is not for naught.
Yeah.
Like, he has definitely become a stronger man because he can admit to himself that he is flawed. He might have issues. Because, again, I also love
and
the fact that...
because he knows
that,
he can rely on his wife and she can rely on
him. Yeah. Because, like, again, it's like the fact that's also the fact that,
come
like,
out stronger.
His wife is freaking the fuck out because he she realizes another aspect, which I can kind of get with the ending if people are kind of iffy on it. Not only is he seeing the storm, his daughter, it seemed like their daughter implies that she had been kind of seeing that. But I also think that it's like, there are elements, there have been films that have endings kind of like this where you can be like, yeah, they talk about it later. Yeah, that was not the original intent on this ending.
Sure, yeah.
Nichols, I don't think, has ever really been said.
I don't think so.
Yeah. And I think that makes sense because I think in terms of, you know, because I think in Jeff Nichols, in his head, if I can assume, of course, but it feels like, you know, like the confidence in Shotgun Stories, I feel like his confidence in the Take Shelter script of being like, whether the storm is real or not at the very end does not matter. It is literally how the bunker scene goes is enough of a thematic, emotional, satisfying, like, you know, just conclusion that whatever happens after that, you know, take it as you will, but it doesn't take away from the film. And that's kind of where I'm at. But I'm glad you feel kind of the same way as well, to a degree, in terms of just liking the ending. Because, again, I understand, because, like, my knee-jerk reaction when I saw the ending of Take Shelter was like, oh, well, I wasn't expecting that. I like that, but I bet not everyone else does. And then I looked it up, and I saw people talking about the film, and then I saw
there's a lot of people who... the ending breaks the whole movie for him.
Yeah, and I could understand that to a degree. But I will also say that I love this movie, and of the three here, this is the one I highly recommend the most, and I think is the best.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of, if not the best, showcase of both Nichols and Shannon's talents.
Yes, absolutely. As well as Jessica Chastain's.
Oh, well, sure.
As well as the Take Shelter is also a film that basically tells the audience, hey, you know who is basically built in a lab for a Jeff Nichols film? Shea Whigham.
Oh, yeah.
On top of Michael Shannon.
What a living, breathing Jeff Nichols character.
And also a surprise appearance by, I believe, Robert Longstreet, who is a big Mike Flanagan guy. He's in a Haunted Hill House.
Yeah,
he's
he plays
Midnight
the
Mass.
Drunk in Midnight Mass.
Yes, and, he's Michael Shannon's boss, and I threw me for a loop to see him. And he's honestly also perfect for a Nicholas film.
I love that guy.
Yeah, he's great.
He pops up in anything.
I love that man's voice. That man should just do animation.
Yeah, he should do voice acting for sure.
He screams like a Japanese anime dub, just like an old man or this like a creature.
Yeah.
He could do that well.
Or some grizzled like detective character.
Yeah. But, yeah, Take Shelter is a phenomenal film, and I think good for Nichols that in the span of a year has this film, which I think really shows a lot of people how damn good he is.
Yeah.
And then the next year has Mud, which basically becomes, I think, an indie darling, a critical darling to a degree, and even makes him even more popular.
Yeah.
And I will also say I probably will watch that in the future. That's the only Jeff Nichols film I have yet to see.
Yeah,
point.
I wanted to watch it just as along with these movies, and I didn't get around to it.
No, we had to watch we had to watch all the Costner films.
Right.
Yeah, we had to watch 3-hour films all the way up to this point.
Too much to do.
Don't lie.
Eggs to lay and worms to scratch. which feels like a Jeff Nichols saying now.
Yeah.
Or a saying by a character in a Jeff Nichols movie. But Mud kind of, at least my perception of Mud without having seen it, is that it kind of like spurred this little mini era of like half indie thriller dramas, like crime dramas. Mm-hmm.
In
like,
the South, kind of.
Yeah, kind of rural America. Mm-hmm. Like there was that Nicolas Cage movie, Joe.
Joe, yeah.
Was that. That wasn't David Gordon Green, was it?
Maybe. Could have been. I don't know. I have seen Joe, though.
I've seen Joe, but that felt like a movie that came out like in the wake of Mud.
Would Cop Car also be kind of considered a little bit
of
that?
John Watts'
structural debut.
Yeah, it felt like there was like this era of the 2010s where a lot of, you know, particularly male filmmakers were making movies a lot like Mud.
And
I can't speak any deeper to that because I haven't seen Mud, but
my
perception.
Aesthetically wise, I agree. And it's also, I think television also has done that a lot. There's a lot of a lot of Bayou, Deep South shows that have been out in the last decade or so. And hell, this kind of vibe that Mud has even goes into less thriller types, but still dramas like something like Peanut Butter Falcon. In late 2010s. It is fascinating to go
kind
from
of like. Yeah, storybook poverty America, like
pretty much, but in a way that doesn't feel like it's someone talking down
to
the audience.
It's
like,
just set in that environment.
Again, Jeff Nichols is a good old boy from Little Rock, so very much like I watching both Shotgun Stories and Take Shelter and Fuck. Pretty much any of his films and all the other films I have seen of his, anytime there's a small town, there's a a love and nostalgia to it, but not to the point where it sugarcoats that era that it's either shot in or the location.
Yeah.
Where it's like in Shotgun Stories, there is a feeling of like, hanging out with the boys on a stoop and just sitting there drinking is nice. But it's still a shitty little town.
right.
And so it's like, it's good to like how Nichols has such a maturity to his direction and his writing. That it arguably, you would think in your head, well, what if, hypothetically, could it work if he went into a different genre? Maybe go more full tilt into something else. Say, I don't know, a sci-fi road trip action adventure film.
Yeah.
If you are thinking that, you are very psychic because you are one hell of
quite perceptive.
Yeah, very perceptive. You are.
But hey, all of our listeners are smart.
Yeah,
we have smart listeners on
absolutely, and they have all been nice to me when it talks about the Jeff Mike Nichols scenario. No one has ever been mean to me about that, and you know what? I get it. But I am in course talking about the final film in our trilogy. It's not the last time Shannon has been a prominent part in a Nichols
last
film, but he's
lead
last lead
in a feature length film.
Yes, and in a Nichols feature for sure, and that is 2016's Midnight Special, a fascinating film because just from its cast alone, you've got Michael Shannon, Joel Edgerton, Kirsten Dunst, Jaden Martell, who many would know, post this film. I think a year or two after this film, he plays the lead in It, Chapter 1.
Oh, right.
And does parts in Chapter 2. He also plays Michael Shannon's son in Knives Out. And he's also the
Nazi child masturbating in the bathroom.
Yes, he is. Yeah. No more context needed. He's also just been in a bunch of stuff recently.
Yeah.
But at this point, I think this is one of his very first bigger films.
Yeah, had to be.
Kirsten Dunst, as well as Sam Shepard. Bill Camp, who's another character actor who anytime I see that man, I go, good for you.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the most surprising, because this is like a year after Force Awakens.
Yeah.
Adam Driver.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating group of people.
It's funny to watch movies, watch like pre-Star Wars Adam Driver movie. I mean, obviously this came out right after Star Wars, but it's very much pre-Driver cast, or pre-Star Wars casting for Driver.
Yes.
Very much that kind of character he was playing before, and now he just plays entirely different characters.
Absolutely. Which,
good on him.
It's like, I mean, watching Adam Driver performance with glasses, it's like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
It's changed. We're not Ferrari. This is not Ferrari Driver.
Yeah.
But yeah, Midnight Special. The best way I've seen someone describe this, I believe I saw this on Reddit or maybe just a random review where I went, fuck. Now I'll never not be able to think of this as the perfect way to encapsulate Midnight Special. Midnight Special feels like an Amblin, like 80s era Spielberg film with more maturity and less homage than a J.J. Abrams.
Yeah.
Like this right in between. It's like the situation where it's like...
It's kind of a stripped down old Spielberg movie.
It's got like that, like E.T. quality in terms of just like...
Yeah.
The whole aspect of basically Michael Shannon is a father trying to take care of his son who has these, you know, crazy powers that a cult is trying to take advantage of.
It's basically Brightburn. Yeah. Next.
Oh, sorry.
That was a good episode.
I just blue screened so hard right there.
You had to sit there and process what Brightburn was.
I think if I hadn't just made full blown eye contact with you when you said Brightburn with such sincerity, I would have been fine.
Yeah.
It's okay. Brightburn 2 is going to be written by an AI. It's fine. I mean, it just has the energy of like watching Midnight Special for the first time back in like probably 2017, 2018. I probably watched this a year or two after it came out. I was just floored by how, again, this film has a confidence out the gate. We basically kind of feel like we're starting in media res of a narrative.
Oh, it is. Things are already flying off the handle by the time we join.
It's one of the rare occasions where a film is basically talking like we don't see it. And I think a lot of that is because of its budget. But, like, you also don't see, like, they basically are talking about, like, we just did this 2 or 3 days ago.
Yeah.
You know, this is how I got roped into this situation. Yeah, yeah. And, like, usually in a film, when you see that, 9 times out of 10, your brain goes, why the fuck aren't we just seeing that?
Mm-hmm.
But with Midnight Special, considering how fast they're moving, considering how intense the situation is a lot of the times, and also just, like, the context clues... Like, the world building in Midnight Special just shows that Mike Nichols... Fuck, I did it again. Damn it. Jeff Nichols. God, it has nothing to do with their filmographies either. It's rolling off the tongue.
Michael Shannon, Jeff Nichols, Michael
Jeff Shannon,
Nichols.
Michael Shannon.
Yeah.
Joel Edgerton, Jeff Edgerton. You know, you just...
Mike Edgerton, even.
Mike Edgerton. Or his
God
actual...
forbid.
Or his actual brother, Nash Edgerton.
Nash,
But it just... Jeff Nichols could just... handle world building so well, I think, in an actual like big franchise if he wanted to, which he almost did a little bit.
Yeah, what was he gonna
he was gonna do A Quiet Place Day One, which is understandable that he probably just left because of creative differences but like with
probably
Midnight
felt a little hamstrung by that,
because I think the best stuff in Midnight Special, at least in my opinion, and I would love it if it was the opposite for you, but like
I hated it.
The beginning, like literally the first 30 minutes is where I'm like, I am locked in. 30 to 45 minutes, I am like, when Joel Edgerton turns off his lights and puts on the fucking night vision goggles, so no one can see them while they're driving in the night,
That's cool stuff.
That is an energy that, like, that the film holds on to for a decent amount of time.
Yeah, and, well, and just the kind of gradual unfolding of who Joel Edgerton is.
Yes.
Is
yeah.
really cool.
Especially, and also Shannon, because...
And Shannon, because you don't know what's going on at the beginning of that movie.
Because I did kind of spoil a little bit. The whole dad reveal doesn't
you don't know.
Until,
you don't
like, 15, 20. But you can kind of tell.
Yeah, I mean, there's it's either... Yeah, I mean, there's clearly this sort of, like... longing protectiveness coming from Shannon at the beginning, but like you can't really tell, you know, does he feel like he owes this kid something? Does he, you know, did he do something and the kid is a symbol for something? And turns out he's his father.
Because basically the film opens up in a shitty hotel with Jaden Martell wearing
goggles.
swim goggles blue swim goggles,
which he has on like most of the movie,
and like air control headset like headphones under a blanket. And they go, "You ready?" Of course. And they start leaving at night, and then you see on the TV that, oh my gosh, this child has been kidnapped. And then of course it's like, who could have done it? And then they just put Michael Shannon's face plastered everywhere. And then
the
like
villain.
That's and then when it starts, like once it gets to the night vision scene, it just automatically just puts Midnight Special on the screen. And I'm like, you confident son of a bitch. I'm game. I'm in. Let's go. And then from that point forward, I think for the majority of it, it keeps that momentum. It it falters here and there, but I think by the time it gets to the end, going full circle, going from like, this is the first Jeff Nichols film I've ever seen, to now being like, I've now seen nearly all of his films, and now I'm going back to the one that kind of got me into him.
Yeah.
It is fascinating to go back to Midnight Special and be like, I see the flaws in this compared to the other great Jeff Nichols stuff, as well as like seeing inklings of how his style could work in a more, you know, sci-fi, you know, bigger budget sci-fi kind of action adventure road trips scenario. And like, as well as like bigger narratives where it's like, you know, in Shotgun Stories, it's a very grounded family feud between two families and Take Shelter. The hallucinations are the weirdest part of that film. The rest of it's pretty grounded. And then you get to Midnight Special, where it also has a groundness to it, but it still also has, it's grounded, but it also has a cult, government, belief that there might be some special prophecy that's coming through because of this.
Sci-fi parallel dimension stuff.
Yeah, and it is very bold, again, for
it's
his
ambitious.
fourth film to do that.
Yeah.
Especially after being like, probably a bunch of people were probably like, oh my god, the Mud guy's doing his next
film. Get Jeff Nichols on the phone.
Yeah, I want him to do Mud 2. And they do Midnight Special, and they go, fuck, that's not what we wanted.
Mud 2, Clay Boogaloo.
But, I mean, it just, again, did you say this was your first one as well when you initially?
I had never seen this.
You had never seen this?
No. I remember, I actually think I remember you raving about it at the time.
Probably,
I remember kind of hearing about it, like, oh, that seems cool. I remember also confusing it. I would confuse it with the J.J. Abrams movie, Super 8. I don't know why. I've never seen that movie either.
I know why.
Okay.
Is Michael Shannon
in that?
No, I think it's just visually there are some. It's not as lens flary as Super 8.
Well,
but
how
again,
could it be?
No. But again, I think that is the Amblin aspect of it. Where it's like
it's this like kind of. It feels like a modern stripped down version of a Spielberg movie.
But the thing that's so funny is Super 8, a film that again I also love. As of now, I haven't rewatched it in years. Probably kind of iffy on it a little bit now. But like that movie is basically J.J. Abrams going, God, aren't Spielberg films awesome? Don't you remember
the Ready Player One of
a little
of Spielberg
bit?
Tributes?
Don't you remember? Like, did you ever make home videos that just because you loved E.T. so much? I sure did. And there's nothing wrong with that. Again, the nostalgia in that film I think works incredibly well. And I think J.J. I think Super 8 probably still is my favorite. It's either that or Mission Impossible 3 of J.J.'s films. But on the flip side, though. Is you have Nichols, who feels like that could have been the easiest way to do Midnight Special.
Yeah.
It's being like, God, don't you love Close Encounters? Don't you love E.T.? But it really just feels like Nichols, at a point, just goes like, I'm going to basically ground the feeling, the almost the tone of those types of films where it's like, you know, E.T., Close Encounters, there's these... you know, nostalgic feelings when you look back on old school Amblin, but there is like a darkness there.
Yeah.
That is like a very grounded seriousness that is there that, like, you know, you don't really think about is there until you rewatch those films and you go, oh, fuck, that's a little more intense than I remember it. And it's like Nichols is almost like, I'm going to take that. I'm going to amp up the maturity, amp up the intensity a little bit.
Yep.
And maybe amp up the weirdness a little bit. And I'm just going to go for it and do my own thing. Like I think JJ as a director, and that's, if we ever do an Abrams trilogy, I'd have to look in to see if that's what we would do with that. Probably a Rise.
The lens flare trilogy.
But like,
there's way too many.
Yeah. But I think with like Abrams, it's like, he is a good director and he wears his,
Influences
on his sleeve. And I think a lot of people, it depends on who you ask, but a lot of people could say that that is a detriment to certain aspects of certain films.
Yeah, I think
films.
It can come as a detriment sometimes.
Yeah. And there's one film in particular that we both probably would say that is a case, and we won't say it because it involves a big sci-fi franchise that, you know, maybe we won't talk about.
Another. Yep.
It's Star Trek. That's definitely what I'm talking about. No. But with Nichols, it is the case where it's like, with his films at this point, like, he is also in that same case where he's wearing his influences on his sleeve. But I think, again, that confidence doesn't make it a detriment, because I feel like it's like those influences are there, but I'm not pulling things straight up from a Steinbeck story or a Twain story. It's more like the essence of a narrative or the essence of a story, and then just kind of forming it into my own interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
My vision and execution of a story that, you know, Spielberg could have done in the 80s, but didn't. And I think Midnight Special does that really well. And I think, you know, the times where it doesn't do that as well is, I think, is where it depends on, you know, mileage may vary in terms of where it's like, okay, this is less Spielberg-y and more Nichols in this scene or that.
I think the maybe where this kind of falters, or maybe it doesn't feel quite as tight or as confident as, say, Take Shelter, for example, is I think in leaning in closer, like leaning in harder into the sci-fi adventure element of it.
Yeah.
It loses some of the like emotional gravitas.
Oh,
of something
no.
Like
yeah.
Take Shelter. I wanted a little bit more of the father-son relationship, since that's ultimately what it's all about.
Yeah. Let's get into that.
We can talk about that a little bit.
I would argue, even though I would consider this still better than Shotgun Stories, I think this is, in my opinion, I think Midnight Special is maybe a 7.5, and the Shotgun Stories is a 7. I would argue, though, in these three films, Shannon's performance is the weakest of the three films in this.
Yeah, I think it also demands the least of him.
Yes, again, because I think a lot of it, too, is the benefit of both Shotgun Stories having, you know, a smaller, more unknown cast, and like the benefit of like Take Shelter having just a smaller cast, is the fact that, like, you know, when Shannon is brought up more, it really accents just how good of a director, how good of an actor he is, and how he can hold scenes and hold, you know, the energy of the movie by himself if need be.
Yeah.
And then in Midnight Special, I would argue, is like the biggest ensemble of these three films.
Uh-huh.
The most jumping between locations of all three of these films. We are going long swaths without any Shannon at times.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
It's at a point where when you, like, I agree with you. I think the emotional aspect between him and his son, while I think both Michael and Jaden are really good in this movie,
mm-hmm.
I do think the moments that should really make you break down crying, like a film, like an Amblin style film would do, doesn't necessarily hit as hard.
They don't get the time to like make those pay off, I guess, is how I would put it. There's not quite enough detail put into the setup to make those moments, even though they are there, pay off as they should.
Yes. And it's also, I think, the aspect of the fact that, like, there, since it's still so inherently grounded in a way, because that's how Nichols has kind of held his career up until now. You know, if you just got off the ground just a little bit more than the film does, maybe we were able to kind of accentuate more of the emotional aspects in terms of just like the otherworldly, as well as just like how this could be the last time you see your son. Cause that's like an aspect of the film brings up a lot, is the fact that, like, if your son is to be safe, that could also mean you may never see him again.
Mm-hmm.
How does that make you feel? And again, Shannon sells it the best he can with the amount of time he has and with the amount of, you know, the script gives him. And, you know, arguably, I think this is more, this is the most ensemble-y of all three of these films. And I think shows just how good the cast is, because it's like when Shannon doesn't have a lot to really do to deliver, I think Edgerton delivers in those moments. And I think, I mean, Dunst is the same way, where it's, I think Kirsten Dunst, you know, we've been talking a lot about actors that we put in our back pocket, where it's like, if they're in this, fucking them down.
You'd put Mike Dunst in your back pocket?
Yeah, I put Mike Dunst in my back pocket. Mike Edgerton, Mike Dunst, Mike Martell.
And Jeff Shannon.
And Jeff Shannon. No, I think Kirsten Dunst, I think especially, just like, again, she is not given a lot. She's given, I would argue, less than him, than Michael. And I would even argue that, like, she's just as good in a subdued way. I think she really holds her own in this movie. And I think there's one scene in particular where there's like a genuine intensity. It's like the outside the hotel room scene. That's a really good scene where, like, that's where Michael, like, where that's where Shannon's going hard. That's when Dunst is doing really good. Like, that's where the emotions are at their peak, and there's still 20 minutes in the film. So when that scene actually, the finale of the film actually happens, and I like the visual aspect of, like, the ending.
It's
really cool, but it is kind of fascinating to think that this is a film where, you know, it is about the father-son aspect, and while the mother-son relationship is a part of it, Michael Shannon's our lead. It is kind of fascinating to have the film end not with Michael Shannon's character, Roy, bringing his son to that point. The fact that it's his mother, I mean, is still impactful to a degree, but I think it would have hit harder.
Yeah, considering we've spent the most time. It feels like an odd sort of switch up.
Yes.
Because while, like, you're right, Kirsten Dunst is really good in this, it doesn't really feel like she's what it's about until kind of suddenly at the end.
And there's also other aspects where it comes with, like, Adam Driver's character, I think, is a lot of fun in the early parts of the film. And then, like,
by the end, you're like, why is he still here?
And you're like, oh, I'm glad you're okay.
Yeah.
Like, it's, that's fine. And, like, it's also, like, the end of the film also, like, because, again, with the maturity aspect, kind of, like, where in my head it's, like, it's a more mature version of, like, an Amblin-style film. It's, like, it's not as silly or as kooky or as funny.
It's much more serious.
Until, like, the second half, where there's a little bit of moments where it's, like, I can, and, like, in my brain, I'm, like, this is the part where you think someone's going to laugh in the theater.
Yeah. Like, you're talking about when Joel Edgerton shoots a cop, right? Just making sure we're on the same page.
But I will say that that scene, again, you know, adding more to the fact that the first 30 to 45 minutes are fucking great.
Yeah.
Is that when that scene happens, it throws you the fuck off.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it also, when you find out later that Joel Edgerton is also a cop.
Yeah, that's a knee slapper right there.
Yeah, that also makes you go, holy shit. Like, because, like, that whole interaction that he has post that shooting where it's like, you shot him in the vest. And it's like, yeah, but you didn't know that. You didn't know he had a vest on. Oh, it's like, no, he said he had a vest on. Michael Shannon does. And then Edgerton knows, you didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, there's, like, that energy that is, like, very intense. And that's the first half of the film. And then the second half of the film is Adam Driver being like, can you punch me?
Right.
So, like, you know, maybe handcuff me to something. And it's like, Joel Edgerton's character is like, what the fuck are you talking about? And it's like, it's not funny. It just feels a little off compared to what we've been watching. Especially when the finale really is just Roy, Michael Shannon's Roy and Joel Edgerton's character running away from the cops to give Kirsten Dunst enough time to get their son to the parallel. That it ends kind of with them getting arrested.
Yeah, right.
But there's a great ending shot in the prison that kind of implies that.
Yeah.
Where the, like, again, almost very Take Shelter-esque, where it implies that there's more to this than just, like, a once-in-a-lifetime. Maybe there's more to it than we could think. And it doesn't, and again, it doesn't feel like a sequel, like, oh, Midnight Special 2. Like, it doesn't feel like that. It just feels like, you
1
know.
1 a.m. special.
Yeah. It's the
Midnight Special happy minus hour. 1.
Yeah. It's happy hour.
Closing time. Midnight Special 2, closing time.
But I think the one thing about watching Midnight Special again and just being like, I don't love it as much as when I first watched it. Because I think when I first watched it, I probably would have given it like an 8.5.
Yeah.
And then now it's a 7.5.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make me not recommend it any less. Like, in all honesty, I think, like, the reason why it's lesser, you know, ranking-wise for my Jeff Nichols films. Jeff Nichols, the director that I have totally...
Mike Nichols, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
I should have known better that you were going to do this. But it's the fact that, like, Jeff Nichols is such a goddamn good director, and he has used Michael Shannon so well in throughout both of their careers, that the fact that Midnight Special is considered maybe one of their weaker films, I think is a good telling of just how good their relationship is.
Sure, yeah.
And how much more. Because, like, the same year that Midnight Special comes out, Loving, which also has Joel Edgerton and has Michael Shannon in a smaller role, but still is pretty phenomenal in it. Like, it just shows that, like, at this point, if Jack Nichols does a film without Michael Shannon, I think he'll just shoot himself in the foot with most people, where it's like, come on, no, bring him back.
Yeah.
Why, no, please have Michael there. I want him there.
Yeah, I like how this trilogy kind of winds up serving as, I don't think this was Jeff Nichols' intent or
Mike part Nichols?
I don't think this was his intent, because I haven't really heard him talk about it with any of these movies. But these three specifically, with Shannon as a lead, it's almost like Nichols is kind of, you know, leveraging the multi-talented nature of Michael Shannon to explore the different roles and relationship of men.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of like, you could make an argument this is like a trilogy of masculinity, like a trilogy of healthy masculinity.
Yeah.
Because in the first movie, he's a son and a brother. His name's literally Son.
His name is Son. We should talk about
he's fulfilling the role of son and brother and kind of surrogate father in a way.
Yeah.
And then in the second one, he obviously is a father, but his kind of primary relationship is as a husband in the film, and his relationship with his wife. And then here it's all about fatherhood. And so I think it's kind of a cool way of looking at it, that these two artists have had this consistent through line of examining male relationships or masculine roles in their movies,
and
whether or not that was intentional.
Well, I think it definitely is intentional, because, again, I think even to even add more to your fatherhood kind of connection, it's also the fact that Midnight Special is about the absence of a father.
Yeah,
because it's like Roy was a part of the cult that his son was in, but his son was always pushed as the head of the cult's son.
Yeah.
Like, they basically took...
Stole his
son
fatherhood from him.
Yeah, stole the fatherhood from him. So a lot of the film, which again just accentuates just how there should be a little bit more in the script for both him and Jaden.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like, the film is also him trying to basically reconnect with a son who is, like, on the verge of becoming a teenager. So there's a lot of, you know, aspects to it.
We should have had a puberty talk.
But again, just think of like Michael Shannon in that film, where it's just like he's very coarse. He is very matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
And he talks about his son like there are moments where he talks about his son like it's, you know, he is a father trying to keep his son alive. But other times he talks about his son like a prophet.
Right.
Like a bodyguard trying to protect, like, a government figure.
I don't think he literally says, like, he's the key to all this, but there are lines like that.
Yeah, and it's also, like, you know, the early on in the film, it's like Michael Shannon is just outright saying, like, listen, I don't want that cop to die, but my son is more important.
Yeah.
And then Joel is just looking at him being like you gotta fucking listen to what you just said.
Yeah.
And you said that in front of your son, no less.
Right.
Who is still a child.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think the fatherhood connection to all three is also a very strong part of it. And I think that's a good call. So Andy gets 20 odd trilogy points.
20 cinephile points.
20 Kino points. Kino coins.
Kino coins.
You can, where can we cash those out at?
Letterboxd.
Any coffee shop that has David Lynch merch.
Oh, God. The Can-Can. Coins. Shout out Can-Can. Local cinema. Support local theaters.
It wasn't even the fact that you called it the Can-Can Kino Coins. It's just how you, like, hit a brick wall.
I was, like, workshopping it mid-sentence. Yes.
Yeah. It's a great tight five. We're working on it. But Yeah, that is the Nichols Shannon sampler.
Yeah.
And
I don't know if you have seen it, but there is one other Shannon lead directed by Nichols project.
Is it what I think it is? Is it
the 2018 Jeff Nichols directed an 8-minute short film called Long Way Back Home, starring Michael Shannon, which I watched. It's on YouTube.
Okay.
And there's not a whole lot to it. It's Michael, okay. Michael Shannon's a dude who comes into town. He clearly has a history with some people, and he's looking for some guys who screwed him over.
Okay.
And he looks around town, and there's a music that plays. I think there's a song, maybe it's partially a music video. There's a song called Long Way Back Home that plays in it, and yeah.
Wait, Shannon doesn't sing, does he?
Shannon doesn't sing.
Ugh.
But you can hear the music coming out of him.
I'm already in watching that, but if he had started singing, I'd be...
he broke out in song.
I would have stopped the episode right now, and I would have started
watching. It's actually
watching
a Nickelback music video. I left that part out. Yeah.
I literally thought you were going to tell me that Jeff Nichols directed the Sorority Letter reenactment that Michael Shannon does for Funny or Die. And I was going to be like, that is a wild connection if that's true. That really shows how close of friends they would be if that was the case.
Yeah.
But yeah, the Shannon Nichols or Nichols Shannon sampler is don't look at me like that.
I was trying to remember if you said it right.
I said it right the second time.
You did.
The Nichols Shannon sampler is just, again, a wonderful look into both not only Jeff Nichols as a burgeoning director who is still going strong to this day, but also Michael Shannon as a character actor who's been in the game for nearly 40 years now, I think, since his first role. And so, you know, highly recommend all three of these films, even though they're at varying different degrees in quality. I would recommend Take Shelter the most, but I'm saying if you saw like a trailer for The Bike Riders and you're like, this kind of is interesting to me, but like, who is this Jeff Nichols guy? Like, these three films are a perfect way to get acquainted with Nichols as an auteur, as well as Shannon as just the best of his, the work with him, basically.
Yeah. And then if you want to do extra credit and tell your friends that you're better than the Odd Trilogies guys, then you can watch Mug and have us beat.
Oh, my God.
And we'll hand you the reins of the podcast.
You'll get...
it's yours now.
Well, you'll get, what, at least 5 Can-Can cinema...
Kino coins?
Kino coins.
Can-Can Kino coins? KKKK. Be careful. Remember, all 4Ks.
I love it.
All 4Ks are critical. With
oh
a
my
K,
gosh.
Critical.
Watching that light bulb in your head for the coins fight. But yeah, thank you all for listening again. It's good to be back.
It is good to be back. We do have one more trilogy planned for July.
Absolutely.
As we've discussed.
Yes, so... on July 27th, we have our next trilogy, which in honor, not only do we have a new Nichols film that had just come out in honor of this trilogy, in honor of our next trilogy, we just, we really wanted to discuss Kevin Costner, not as an actor, but as a director, as an auteur that has basically gone from making one of the most popular films in the late 80s to the point where it won Best Picture at the Oscars to making one of the biggest flops in the 90s to an underrated maybe a beloved classic in the Western space
in the early 2000s. I mean, Costner's obviously very well known as an actor, but as a director, even considering Dances with Wolves, he's kind of gone overlooked as a director, and I think part of that's probably because he hasn't directed anything in 20 years until now.
Because in honor of him returning for what might be 4 3-hour films that is about an American saga, Horizon, an American saga, we are talking about Kevin Costner, director. We are discussing his first 3 directorial debuts, per se, because now that he's basically going to do more than half of that in the next 3 to 4 years probably. But we are discussing Dances with Wolves, The Postman, and Open Range.
Yep.
3 very interesting films that at this point in our recording, Andy has seen all of them. I'm still in the process of getting to watch Open Range, but I will say it will be nice to watch something that isn't The Postman.
Yeah.
And anything is better than watching The Postman again. That's a good hint into what the conversation is going to be. Plus, go for it.
Yes, speaking of the what the conversation is going to be, we will also be joined by a very special guest, editor, co-founder, and writer over at Midwest Film Journal, Mr. Nick Rogers.
Yes.
Also a member of the Indiana Film Journalists Association. Nick is a huge Costner head. I think he's seen... I don't want to say all definitively without his presence, but almost all of Costner's films.
I would imagine he's watched every single one of his readily available
films. At least.
There's a few films that I think that have been lost in the wayside.
I knew he had seen all of these before we approached him to join us for this. But yeah, Nick is very experienced with the Cost Man and is ready to bring the heat.
Oh my God. Every one of his Letterboxd reviews about these three films have felt like
he's mounting a case.
Yeah, like, he is trying to be the defense attorney for us, which is honestly going to be a lot of fun when we get to The Postman.
Oh, sure.
I cannot wait to hear his takes on that. But yeah, with Nick Rogers, tune in on July 27th when we talk about Kevin Costner, director. But until then, I'm Logan Sowash.
And I'm Andy Carr.
Thank you so much for listening.